So the title of this panel was New Directions. And we've heard a lot about how, for a variety of reasons, we as a society have gotten sort of stuck in one particular groove, a few competing grooves, but one that does not seem to be going anywhere in terms of actually preventing the problems of adolescent sexuality. And as we think about how are we going to move beyond this place of being stuck, there's the question of politics and the question of strategy and the question of how the resources get divided. But I think there's another question, which is that of the paradigm, the ways we actually think and talk about adolescent sexuality. And I think that one of the reasons why the abstinence-only until marriage programs have been able to be so successful is not just politics and resources and the strength of particular political movements, but also because American society has thus far lacked an alternative paradigm to really talk about what it means for adolescents to have a healthy sexuality. What does it mean to have to promote adolescent sexual health? Now, what we have in this society, and to just finish that thought, in order to move, we do actually need a new paradigm, a new way of thinking. And I will be outlining at least the beginnings of such a paradigm for you today. The two paradigms that have prevailed over the last few decades in the United States are, first of all, the abstinence-only until marriage paradigm, which we've heard a lot about. But the second paradigm is really the risk paradigm. According to the abstinence-only until marriage paradigm, sex is a sin, although it is not anymore called that, thanks to the creative retooling of the Heritage Foundation. But that is the origins of this idea, so religious origins. According to the risk paradigm, adolescent sex is a sickness, or at least so close to sickness that you can always consider it to be a risk. And although these two paradigms have different origins, they have in recent years really come to influence one another quite a bit. So the abstinence-only programs have absorbed a lot of language from the public health risk model, getting rid of a lot of the references to sin and importing language about mental health, physical health risks. While the risk paradigm has also absorbed language from the abstinence-only paradigm, such as, for instance, calling certain forms of comprehensive sex education abstinence plus, really like placing the word abstinence at the forefront, as opposed to using a different kind of language that emphasizes how young people should be able to know how to say no and decide when to say yes, instead using that word abstinence. So the two paradigms actually have several things in common. The first is the assumption that adolescent sex is per definition dangerous and risky. And the second is that one of the best ways to counter those risks is to keep teenagers from having sex. And that the third way, that the way to accomplish that is to emphasize the risks and the dangers. But what both paradigms really leave largely out of the picture, that really unaddressed, are what are the psychological skills that teenagers need? What are the relationships that they need, both with peers and potential partners and with their parents, in order to experience sexuality as a positive thing as they are maturing and as they become an adult? These things are largely unaddressed. So to start both questioning some of the assumptions taken for granted and bringing into the picture things that we don't usually talk about in the United States as part of adolescent sexual health, I use an international comparison. Excuse me. I'm going to draw today on that international comparison, which some of you have heard me do before. In order to be able to make these points about how in the United States we need to have a new paradigm for understanding adolescent sexual health. before I moved to my international case, and I have compared the United States and the Netherlands, I will just give you a quick preview of the paradigm I'm moving towards so you have an idea of where I'm going. So I will explain later on in the talk what I mean by this, but I think that there are three things that we really need to emphasize in thinking about adolescence and sexual health. The first is developing in adolescents a sense of their autonomous sexual self, or autonomy in of their sexual self. The second is how to build good romantic relationships. And the third is how to maintain connectedness between adolescents and parents and care providers in the professional arena. Now, some of you may have noticed that this is an ABC model, which I've worked very hard to accomplish over the years. I have struggled with the B especially. So before I develop that, I'm going to go to the Dutch case. Or I'll leave that up there for those of you who want to look at it. Now, the Dutch case is a particularly good one with which to compare the United States, and it is so for three reasons. The first is that it shows very clearly that many of the problems we take for granted in the United States, pregnancy, disease, conflict between parents, some negative feelings, especially on the part of girls after sex, are not at all endemic to teenage sexuality. They are really part of teenage sexuality in this particular cultural context, and far fewer in the Dutch case. Now, these successes in promoting adolescent sexual health were not accomplished by promoting abstinence. The Dutch government and medical profession never pursued that particular strategy. That is not to say that government and public health professionals did not emphasize that teenagers should wait until they're ready and be able to say no and so forth. But the idea that abstinence across the board was the best method was never pursued. Now, the second reason that the Dutch case is an interesting one with which to compare the U.S. is because the cultural frameworks that are used both in the family and in public health circles are so very different from this country that they give us a new way to look at what we take for granted. I mean, I'm even thinking, for instance, of the mini plenary that was just on brain development, which was an adolescence that I assume most of you were at. And it was a very interesting one. But I was sitting there listening, thinking he was emphasizing all the dramatic elements, all the dangerous, explosive, difficult to control elements of adolescent sexuality. There was very little talk about how that other side, that cognitive, controlling, regulating element that, for instance, in Dutch society really gets emphasized, was almost out of the picture altogether. And finally, the reason why the Dutch case is very useful is because as we think about paradigm shift in this country, and you know, like someone last night at dinner said, oh, we've been Puritans for 200 years, we're never going to change. Well, actually, Dutch society went through a huge change between 1965 and 1975. And if we look at Dutch society prior to 1965, the statistics that we just saw by Larry Finer showing that premarital sex was really the norm for a very long time in the US, that was not true in Holland. In fact, Holland was, prior to 1965, perhaps a more conservative country than the United States. There was a tremendous paradigm shift. And in that paradigm shift, medical professionals played a huge role, especially family physicians, but people working in clinics, people doing sexuality research, played a very critical and important role in reframing what was going on, what was good, what was important, how to understand sexuality. So I want you to understand that actually change is possible and that you can play a role in it. So now let's first look at some of the facts in the two countries. And I'm going to go pretty quickly through this to save some time. basically, age of first sex is very similar in the two countries. It occurs about 8 to 10 years before first marriage. So that rough, small decade of premarital sexuality is similar in the two countries. And in that respect, that the majority of adolescents have had sexual intercourse during the teenage years, the United States and the Netherlands are very in keeping with other Western societies. So that is essentially the norm. But the outcomes of adolescent sexual activity are vastly different. So if we look at pregnancy, abortion, and birth rates, we see that pregnancy rates are 6 times as high in the United States as they are in the Netherlands, and abortion rates are 3 times as high, birth rates are 8 times as high. And these differences hold even if we compare only whites in the two countries who have lower absolute numbers. We still see huge differences. There are also large differences in the percentage of youth who have acquired HIV, and there are also large differences in the in STD rates. Those are a little bit harder to compare for reasons that you know, the tracking is difficult between two countries. But if we look, for instance, at gonorrhea, we see that in the Netherlands, gonorrhea rates are 8 per 100,000 which is less than 1/10 of the rates for white American youths. Chlamydia rates are about twice as high in the United States as they are in the Netherlands. So why do we have these huge differences? Well, there are a couple of different reasons. One that should be stated up front is actually poverty. A much higher percentage of American youth live in poverty, and that explains a great deal of the difference. But that is not all that's going on. We also have great differences in contraceptive use. Thank you. The clearest difference is with regard to hormonal contraception. And what's important to note here is that Dutch girls typically are on the pill prior to their first intercourse. And again, I was thinking of the panel on brain development and thinking that, you know, for some reason, these Dutch kids who are probably neurologically wired the same way can remember to take a pill every day. So they can do it, and they do it. But also, condom use is higher in the Netherlands as well. But it's not just about sort of contraceptive use or access to resources and poverty. There's also something going on at a much deeper level. Dutch teenagers express much more of a sense of being in control of their sexual decision-making process. They're far less likely to express regrets. And you can see this at the second slide. So while a large percentage of American teens say they wish they had waited to have sex, in the Netherlands it's fewer than 1 in 10. So the other 90% believe that it happened more or less at the right time. And similarly, in the Netherlands, almost 90% of teens say that they experienced their first sex as something they really wanted. Now, some of the reasons for these positive experiences are found in the quantitative data, which exists for the Dutch case, but not for the American case. So in some large-scale Dutch surveys, we find that 4 out of 5 Dutch teenagers describe their first sexual experiences as fun and as the outcome of a mutual decision-making process where both parties came to a decision. And it's also the case that the most common relationship context in which Dutch teenagers have sex is a steady relationship in which they describe themselves as very much in love. And this is true for both girls and boys. As I said, this kind of information does not exist or is much more spotty in the United States. And it has a lot to do with the paradigms we use and the fact that we actually don't investigate these issues or do not place teen sexuality in this larger context. So far the quantitative data. Now, how exactly does this come to be? Why do these Dutch teenagers have so much more of a sense of control over their sexuality? Why is it a much more positive experience? The research I myself have done is in-depth qualitative, and it looks at the cultural frameworks through which parents and teenagers themselves understand teen sexuality in the two countries. And one of the things that those of you who've heard me talk before, read my articles, know that I focus on is the question of whether or not parents decide to let their teenage kids spend the night together with a boyfriend or girlfriend in the later teenage years, 16 and 17. And this is a very common practice in the Netherlands and not a common practice in the United States. And I use this difference to unpack these larger cultural systems of dramatization in the United States and normalization in the Netherlands. And I'm just going to go through them very quickly right now. Let's see. I'm going to skip the data collection. I will just say about the data collection that I followed the logic of inquiry where you try to compare groups that are as similar as possible in terms of their socio-demographic traits and also in terms of religiosity, which it would be very relevant in this particular case. And the dramatization of teen sexuality hinges, I argue, on three different pieces. The first is the view of teen sexuality as raging hormones out of control. This is what a lot of parents also talk about when they say they would not allow a sleepover to take place because kids cannot really control their own sexual impulses, again, implied by the talk we saw earlier today. A second part of the dramatization of adolescent sexuality in the United States is the concept of the battle between the sexes, the idea that boys and girls really have antagonistic interests and are engaged in a kind of battle where there are winners and losers, which again puts young people at risk if they are going to have sex. And finally, the American parents express the idea of not under my roof. So a teenage child might become sexually active, but it shouldn't happen at home. And one of the things that parents say, besides the fact that it makes them uncomfortable, is that it's important for young people to establish a certain amount of self-sufficiency before parents can accept their children's sexuality, a certain financial autonomy. Is how it's often framed. Now, in the Netherlands, we see something very different. Parents emphasize readiness and self-regulation in children. So parents say generally that they don't really need to prevent their children from having sex, but they need to encourage them to not have it until they themselves feel ready, and to understand readiness as a process that involves self-regulation and preparation for sex through the use of contraception. Second, the Dutch parents talk about adolescent sexuality as being part of a relationship between the sexes. That sexuality is not viewed so much as hormones or behavior, but as part of a relationship context. And finally, parents emphasize the importance of talking about sexuality in a normal way and non-secretive to prevent the alienation between parents and youths. Now, this is obviously quite a different cultural context, and it influences young people in fairly profound ways. I think I'm just going to go into two examples of how these two contexts influence young people. One example comes from the American case. So this is an American teenager. Jesse describes sex as risky business. When he was 14, he was drunk out of his mind, and he lost his virginity to a girl who was also drunk. Without the two knowing each other, Jesse and the girl were like, hey, let's go do this. It just came on spontaneously. The next thing you know, we were in bed. They had sex without protection, but got lucky. No pregnancy resulted. Now 16, Jesse describes himself as an altered man. He's not like the other boys who pursue sex as a matter of instinct, not intimacy. He's head over heels in love with his girlfriend. She's the only one I ever want to have from now on, he says. We're just so happy, and I couldn't imagine being with anyone else. My first priority in life is being in love with my girlfriend and giving her everything I can. The couple uses condoms every time they have sex. Still, Jesse sees it as a big risk to take. It's pretty dumb, he says, that I do have sex, because I'm not ready to become a father right now. That's probably like the worst thing that could happen to me now. If you're not looking to have a baby, sex is definitely a risk. I've had a situation where condoms have broken and I was like flipping out of my mind, about ready to puke. I was like, Jesus Christ, we're dead. I'm screwed for the rest of my life. But it turned out okay, everything is fine. So yeah, that scared the life out of me. So Jesse illustrates what the dramatization of teenage sex does for American teens. The first is that sex is viewed as risk-taking and is experienced as deeply risky, even if you use condoms, which is striking. It was, in fact, one of the biggest differences between American teens and Dutch teens, that the American teens, especially boys, actually, I found, were very afraid of sex and its consequences for their lives, and they did not have a sense of being able to really control those risks. The second thing that Jesse illustrates is that American teens see love as extraordinary, or relationships as difficult to attain only for the sort of chosen few, not something that's part of normal life, not something that is easy to assess, but it's this sort of huge, overwhelming, and difficult to attain thing. And finally, the American teenagers, especially the American girls, emphasize sex as a secret, something that could really ruin your relationships with your parents if they found out. For a lot of American girls, the idea of being a good daughter and becoming sexually active are viewed as in strong contrast to one another. So the second story I want you to read you is from a Dutch teenager. Karsten is 17 and he continues to take a lot of joy in his parents' company. Not only does he see his parents for dinner around 9 o'clock or 9:30, around 9 or 9:30, he says, we're all downstairs in the living room and we can talk or play games, watch television, whatever we feel like doing. We play games at least twice a week, really sitting down for an evening and having a lot of fun. It's really gezellig, it's a Dutch word. It's really congenial. We enjoy each other's company. Karsten lost his virginity with the girlfriend he had for 2.5 months. He was in love with her, which he describes as a special place in your heart for another person. We were talking, and at a certain point we got into the topic, he says, and more or less decided together that she was ready for it too. They spent the night at his house several times, but only after consultation, both with his parents and his girlfriend's parents. Yes, you have to do that. I wouldn't want to get into a fight with an angry father, he says. I've heard those kinds of stories from my father, that my grandpa went after him with a shotgun. Nothing so dramatic took place in Kirsten's generation, but a careful dance preceded the sleepover. We talked about it, kind of very carefully, feeling our way. My parents were like, what exactly do you want? And I was like, well, what exactly would they allow? And after a while, I just asked plainly, would it be allowed? And they said yes. They'd rather that I'm at home when I'm going to do something like that than elsewhere, because they know if something's going to happen, it's going to happen. And if it happens at home, at least they know where I am. So Kirsten illustrates normalization from the teenager's point of view. First of all, sex as preparation. It's something that you can get ready to do by talking with your parents, by getting contraception. It's not something that just happens to you. Second of all, love is normal. It's a special place in your heart. It's part of life, as one of the boys that I interviewed said, well, doesn't everyone want intimacy? It's such a natural, normal part of life, not this extraordinary thing that only a few people can do. And finally, sex as negotiation with parents, with authority figures, rather than sex as a furtive thing that's hidden. So it is clear that, to just bring this sort of down to ground a little bit, that these aspects of normalization have huge impacts on things that people working in STD prevention would care about. Obviously, if sex is preparation, it's something that young people are going to think about more. It isn't a stigma, for instance, to carry a condom. It is part of being, you know, a responsible young person. Also, when relationships, and especially, this is one of the things that I think is important, when Dutch kids also have a way of talking about what it means to have a good relationship, being able to talk together, being able to negotiate together, being able to enjoy each other's company, which seems so banal, but is actually pretty important in a relationship. With that kind of relational foundation, of course, it becomes a lot easier to negotiate about contraceptive use and condom use. And finally, if kids are expected to negotiate with their parents about when sex is right and when a sleepover is allowed, then they are also used to talking with adults about sexuality in an open and honest way, which makes it a lot easier to ask for help from care providers, to speak frankly about what's going on. So, the reason that the Dutch case is important to put out there is to open our minds, right? So it's so easy when you're operating in a society where the facts and the ideas seem to reinforce one another, to think this is the only way it can be, and this is the only way we can talk about it, or these are the only factors we can look at. It is something that basically literally opens our mind. But when we think about sort of how do we bring it here and what does that mean, there are a couple of things to take into account. First of all, that it is not the case that, for instance, I'm saying, oh, everyone should just like permit sleepovers and this is how we're going to end STD problems. That's not what I'm talking about. But I do think that it allows us to actually look more critically at these paradigms that we take for granted and to ask what are the pieces of the puzzle that need to be in our paradigms that we don't have? And then how do we find an American-based language and understanding to actually integrate these? So first, I want to talk about the critically assessing the paradigms briefly again. And through the lens of this Dutch case, and I'm also going to bring in especially as I discuss the new paradigm, American-based research, because it's not just, I think the international comparison makes the most radical point, but we actually have research coming out within the US that corroborates some of the ideas that I'm going to put forth. Okay, so the existing paradigms that we have, the first, the abstinence or no sex paradigm. Well, one of the real problems in using the word abstinence is that it makes sex an either-or thing, when in fact, especially at adolescence, it is a process, and I believe should be a process, that starts very slowly with, like, kissing. You know, I had a foster daughter for a while who's talked about making out, but what she meant with making out was just kissing, you know, like that for her was like a big deal. And that should be part of what we think about when we think about adolescent sexuality, appropriate, age-appropriate forms of intimacy. You can't do that if it's an either-or thing. The second problem is that it provides a code and not true empowerments. So this is what you're supposed to do. These are the steps you're supposed to go through. Most notably, don't do it. But it doesn't actually get into young people. It doesn't actually give them the skills to navigate sexuality once they're outside of the context of that place that gives them that particular code. And I think we see that very well in that virginity pledge research that shows that it works for a short period of time, but once kids are out of that particular context, it doesn't give them the tools to navigate condom use and so forth. And it gives no tools for navigating relationships. One of the implicit promises in the abstinence only until marriage paradigm is that if you somehow don't have sex, you're going to have a great marriage. You know, like there is this idea that there's sort of an insurance policy. If you refrain, your marriage is going to be good. But it actually doesn't in any way address the relationships that young people are forming today, or the fact that you have to practice relationships to get good at them and learn things. You don't wake up one day and now you have a great marriage. And finally, the abstinence or no sex paradigm makes it hard to discuss sex when it does happen. And I think this is sort of, this point should really be exploited better by people who know how to do it. But really, if part of what the abstinence only until marriage movement tries to say is that this is a model for promoting good marriages eventually, but also for family values. But in fact, it makes it very difficult for young people to talk to their parents. It inhibits the kind of contact and connection that the Dutch parents are able to make, and that American parents who are able to talk with their kids are also able to make. So it inhibits this connection between parents and teens. But I think there's also ways that we have to critically look at the sex as risk-taking paradigm, which is if anything, more dominant in this country and certainly probably in this room. And I think that we have to ask ourselves, does it make sense to talk about something as a risk when it is in fact normative behavior and part of growing up all across the advanced industrial world? Is it really helpful to young people to pathologize sex, to suggest that it's akin to disease or that it's akin to risk, when we know that many young people actually don't take that many risks? That in fact, if under good circumstances, contraceptive, condom use, a relationship, it isn't necessarily that risky. Does talking about sex as in and of itself risk-taking allow young people to actually distinguish between real risks and not real risks? I mean, one of the things that's so striking to me, the American teens, is that they feel that sex is per definition dangerous, even if they use condoms every time. One girl says, yeah, I don't want to take the risk of ruining my life just, you know, to have sex. And I'm not sure the sex as always being risk about risk is helping them actually assess their risks. And then third, it instills fear rather than a sense of mastery and control. Now, I don't want to say that fear is never appropriate or that it never results in learning, which of course it does. But the bigger issue is what is it that young people need to develop mastery, to develop control. And I do not think that fear is the best motivator in that regard. And finally, a lot of the sex as risk-taking thinking leaves out the relational context of sexuality, the larger framework. What are the relationships in which sexuality takes place? What are the features of a good relationship, a not good relationship, and how do these affect quote-unquote risk-taking behavior? So these are my critiques of the two paradigms we have, and how do we go beyond them? I think the first thing to recognize is that both the paradigms we have actually don't really talk very much about adolescent sexuality. There are ways to not talk about it. And that is, for instance, when we use an expression like abstinence plus, what does this mean? You know, with these two little words, and a whole world is hidden in it and does not get discussed. And I was thinking about it last night, that what we're talking about in this case is not so much getting outside of the box, but getting into the black box, the black box we never talk about. So what is sexuality needs to be discussed, but also what is adolescence? What is sexuality at adolescence? And so to think about how we can bring the issues of what is healthy sexuality, what allows a young person to make sexuality a healthy part of their adolescence, I think we need to connect with some things that are already recognized and valued to be true about adolescence in the United States. And the first thing that is recognized, sort of beyond dispute by most, is that autonomy is a really important part of what adolescents are supposed to do during their growing up. And that we can extend that concept of autonomy to sexuality in ways that I think will help us to understand what is healthy, what young people should wait for until they have it, how to set up a sort of a little bit of a system of accountability. You demonstrate this level of autonomy, then you could maybe be ready. There's a way to actually measure it. The second piece is building good romantic relationships. What is a good romantic relationship? And the third is maintaining connectedness between adolescent and care providers. So let's go for the A first, developing autonomy of sexual self. And I should mention that this framework is one that I am beginning to develop, but not just based on my own research. Also, a lot of research that comes from feminist sociologists, psychologists, who've really emphasized that it's very important for young women especially, but it's also true for men, to be able to own and control their sexual decision-making process. They need to be able to recognize and articulate their own wishes and boundaries, or when to know how to say yes or no. This can include abstinence, obviously. This includes knowing when not to have sex. I think that it would involve being able to anticipate and adequately prepare for sexual activity, and also to know what it means to feel sexual pleasure and to enjoy sex, which for many girls is still a challenge. Now, I think that when we fill in this blank, like this blank box, and look for the autonomy of sexual self, it actually gives us a sort of more rational way to think about when are young people ready, and also to unpack this monolithic category of teenagehood, adolescence. Just as we expect sort of other aspects of autonomy to develop over time, to develop gradually, I think that the same is true with regard to sexuality. So when we think about when is sex good and when is it not, I think the research shows us that, especially for girls, early adolescence is not great, and probably for boys too. But once you hit middle adolescence, and especially sort of late, There is really no evidence to suggest that there are negative outcomes. I think that 5 minutes? Yeah, I'll be done in five. I'll probably be done in less than five. I want to highlight here for a moment the piece about pleasure and enjoyment of sexual contact. Some of the existing feminist research shows us that actually when girls are able to recognize their own sexual pleasures, they are also much more able to recognize when they're being violated, to be able to recognize sexual danger. There's also research to suggest that girls who have a high level of what is often called sexual subjectivity, awareness of their own sexuality, their own feelings, their desires, that they are also better able to do things as like use contraception, that sexual subjectivity and agency go together. So these are emphasizing this autonomy of sexual self, the ability to know what you want, to take a charge of it, to take responsibility for it, does result also in better contraceptive behavior. So research suggests. The second piece is the relationship piece. Now, American adolescents, I think, are very hungry for language about relationships. Learning research, various different research has found that teenagers would like to actually talk more about what are good relationships, to have that opportunity. The emphasis on relationships is also a real uniter, to like use that language. It's something that right and left in America can actually agree on. And it's something that parents and kids might find easier to talk about. So what does it mean to build good romantic relationships? Some of these things are very basic, but they actually don't really get spelled out. Get to know each other, build trust over time, figure out how to deal with conflict, strive for equality. This speaks, of course, to the question of large difference in age, and enjoy one another's company. Now, one of the research that just came out, which was just in the paper a few days ago, was a research project done by Child Trends that showed that, in fact, young women who were in relationships with relative equal power equality and also who saw their relationships as clearly romantic were better contraceptive users. So again, there are real payoffs. And finally, if we emphasize autonomy, which is an individual developmental process, if we emphasize romantic relationships, which are relationships with peers, we also need to emphasize the continuation of connectedness between adolescents and parents and care providers. Research, again, has showed that connectedness, and this is something you see both in American and Dutch research, promotes overall well-being, also promotes efficacy in all kinds of areas, including contraceptive use. And I think here is a piece where what I have to say and sort of what John was saying earlier kind of hook up, which is that it's important in order to have a true connectedness, there has to also be a true honesty and integrity in the communication between young people and their parents, and also young people and professionals. If young people are going to school and they are not receiving medically accurate information, if they're receiving information that doesn't add up, that seems to have all these blind spots in it, how connected are they actually going to feel? How likely are they going to be to trust the people who are supposed to help them? So another paradigm, another ABC. I think that these things that I've outlined, the questions of how does a young person come to make sexuality a healthy and good part of their lives are important to be able to talk about at many different levels. I think providers need to have an idea, service providers need to have ideas about these different pieces of the puzzle, but also in policy debates, there needs to be a language to address these pieces that I've talked about. Because I think that, as I started off by saying, if we don't talk about what actually adolescent sexual health really is, then it is always possible to just say, okay, don't do it. That's the best way. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Shalit, for a new set of ABCs. We will invite questions or comments from the audience now. Thank you very much for staying, and of course, if you need to leave. We do, I think, have some more videos, DVDs in the back. Please. Thank you. The questioner it gave a compliment and agreed with the this new paradigm approach. Thank you very much. In the back, please. The questioner is raising the issue of how to connect sort of these ABCs for adolescents to make it sort of a lifelong connection connect adolescents and issues of relationships as people get older.
I would say yes. I see it as applicable more generally, and that I think it would be important in American society to open up this conversation, not just for young people, but also for adults. I would just say that the two reasons to emphasize it in particular for teenagers is A, that they are learning, or should be learning anyway, and that there are things that are important to emphasize with teenagers that don't get enough emphasized, like, for instance, the continued connectedness. It's true for adults too, but it's especially true for teens. And the taking it slow, may also be true for adults, but it's especially true for teenagers, you know. So I think that these I think that adolescents, you know, I keep thinking back to the speaker earlier. I hope you guys heard it, the person who spoke about brain development. Because one of the things he did say is that teenagers, they have all these impulses, but it's also a time of potential creativity, goals, and so forth. And I think that we can also use our dream. I mean, so much of what's happened over the last 20 years is the negative side of adolescence has been emphasized. But we as a culture also have dreams for adolescence. And I think we can exploit, if you will, those cultural dreams in order to move forward a change that would hopefully have a ripple effect into adulthood. And I actually want to take that question, if I may. Very good question, and it's not one I can give you an immediate answer to. You know, I just have to think through. I think I see an area where I see difference and where I don't see difference. The whole sort of the prevalence of child molestation and people moving into the neighborhood and the child predators piece that's so strong here, this is not something that with which I was at all familiar in the Netherlands when I was growing up there. So in a sort of qualitative, you know, impressionistic way, I did not see that. But I think that when we look at sort of sexual coercion in general, there's actually less difference than you would think, to be honest, especially when you look at a non-college educated population. When you look at a college-bound or college-educated population, the rates of sexual coercion are quite a bit lower in Holland. So there's a big class difference when it comes to sexual coercion and experience with it. It's an important issue. Oh, okay, sorry, just quickly. The question was about childhood sexual abuse and the differences between the two countries.
Next question is, if sexual coercion was as frequent as in the United States, how come it makes you think that young people are happy with initiation?
No, I mean, I think that this is a really interesting, I mean, another way of putting it is, how come the effects, so sexual coercion does not necessarily, I mean, it could be all kinds of times. But there may also be a difference in the effect that a coercive experience has on young people. I mean, one of the things that it did not come up in my own data, but one of the things that did come up in my data was the experience of a young Dutch woman who had sex before she was 100% sure, the way she put it. She was not coerced, but she said yes before so she belonged in the 1 in 10 that felt it happened too early. But what was interesting is that when I interviewed her, she had had a way to understand what had happened to her, to think it was not wise, to think that she should not repeat it. In fact, she avoided lengthy relationships after that. But she said, now I'm ready. Now I would really like to have sex. As opposed to, it ruined me for life. You see, so that's one of the things that we might be talking about, is the impact of negative experiences when you have a language with which to understand how you could also be more empowered. Yes?
It's not just the language, it's the fact that I think that the Dutch start at a level of empowerment and self-control much higher than the U.S.
Yes. I think that's really true, and oh, sorry. So it wasn't a question, but it was a comment that the Dutch teenagers start at a sort of higher level of inner psychic resources to experience empowerment and sense of control, and I think that's true, and I think that it's actually produced by a higher level of connectedness You know, that's the irony. I think that this kind of connectedness in the family and a sense of accountability also produces more of a sense of self-control. I think the two actually go together. Yes. So the question was, how does this normalization affect non-majority members of society? And where I thought you were first going to go was to non-heterosexuality, and I was immediately going to say, oh, it totally applies to that, because it does. But your question ended up being about different ethnic groups. I think that there's two things to say about that. One is that there clearly are multiple cultures, and that this culture of normalization is one of the dominant white Dutch population. But that one of the things, the slide I didn't show, which is really interesting, is that when you look at immigrant groups and you look at teen birth rates, they're very high in Holland at the first generation, and they totally come down in the second generation. I mean, in a kind of striking way, that it's like if there were ever sort of an example of actually like acculturation having a huge effect, that is one. But I don't mean to suggest that, you know, people, you know, that there's a total assimilation, or that there even should be. But I think in that particular area, you actually do see a really strong effect of having lived in the Netherlands for one generation. Right.
And that sort of seems to be the abstinence until marriage, because forgetting about the ideology, what it removes is the whole issue of judgment. And I think that this gets at how do we develop healthy sexuality, and how do we develop a population for judgment. Now, one of the things I would limit is that obviously fear is a problem, but there is a question about how do we convey appropriate respect for the consequences of sex. If pregnancy is less of an issue with the people, that STDs surely are not. And it's not as though the Netherlands have solved the problems of STDs. Mm-hmm. They have an appreciable committee of parents, and they're planning to restrain programs, for example. So it's there as a problem. The question is, how do you deal with it appropriately without making it fear-based?
Mm-hmm.
Not as
well,
I think, to solve that problem.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Brooklyn Collins moved your time perspective, like the Rosen Hotel, and left Phil plus and the alternative top for the Afghani rate.
No, actually, they use more pill.
Yeah,
excuse me?
Yeah,
right.
Was
right. I mean, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. is not a model to compare. Mm-hmm. That is not the gold standard.
Right.
But the question is it acceptable, or should there be a little more concern about the consequences of sex? Not fear, but at least the healthy respect, just like driving a car. You know, when you
right.
get into a car, you need to understand you take a chance every time you get in the car.
Mm-hmm.
The benefits and the risks, and maybe you don't drive when it's raining, maybe
right,
or the headlights aren't so great, and you don't drive when you're tired. I'm saying, is that adequately addressed in your belief, given that STDs have not necessarily been solving the problem in the Netherlands?
It's a good question. So, I'm going to repeat the question and think as, okay. Maybe one of you wants to talk, right, when I get a really hard one. but let me first see if I can repeat it. So the question is, if I understand you correctly, does the Dutch society deal enough with making young people or any people aware of the possible consequences of sex, especially around STDs? I'll give a very quick answer. One of the things that, of course, happened in Holland was this incredible emphasis on the pill, and that pregnancy was essentially removed as something to worry about. And when AIDS came, there was then an emphasis on condoms. But it is true that I think that there is a disproportionate amount of the contraceptive work being done by girls, and that has led boys a little bit off the hook in the Dutch case. So I would just grant you that. And I think the other thing that I would just say is that I think that the Dutch normalization of teen sexuality happened at a certain time, in Dutch history, and that now they're somewhat dealing with a new period of time and looking more critically at some of the problems that still remain, including the kinds of problems that you're talking about. Okay.
Hi, Stuart. I would say it's a question of how you spin things, where you emphasize things. Yes. What is acceptable risk? I mean, it's not honest to say there's no risk, but on the other hand, obviously it can be exaggerated out of proportion. I'm reminded of one time in the STD clinic where I work, if someone had warts, they were told, you're going to have this lifelong viral infection, you'll never get over it. People would leave in tears, And now, of course, we say, you got warts, you'll lose it. It's just sort of like what the attitude should be about it. And I agree, there should be some sense of acceptable risk.
Well, I mean, the risk of living and loving. I mean, everything that's worthwhile in life has a risk. And I do actually think that the issue of accountability and having some sense of, if then, is a really important part of developing this, autonomy and sexual self. I think that you actually do better developing that sense of accountability and control when you emphasize the mastery piece as opposed to the lack of control piece.
Stuart, I think there's partly an answer to your question, and then partly I want to add a little bit of data. I think once you have a dialogue going, you can introduce a dialogue about STDs. So you have a dialogue here about going on in Holland, in the Netherlands, about pregnancy, primarily in relationships. So I think you can then craft onto that, a more nuance. The other piece of it is the dual method use in Europe is much, among teenagers, is much higher than any of the data in the school survey that just came out a few months ago demonstrated much higher rates than we see here. So, and again, that's probably around HIV as opposed to STDs, but kids rapidly responded to that.